You're listening to episode 350 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast. I'm your host, Dr. April Seifert. On this podcast, we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this episode of the podcast. My name is Dr. April, and I'm so thrilled that you're here. We are diving into an important topic this week that has directly impacted me in the last, I would say, 12 to 18 months, and I'm so excited to share it with all of you. Now, if you are anything like me, maybe some of you are, you focus so much on being logical. We try to think through the most rational way to make a decision. We weigh pros and cons, costs and benefits, and we try to make what is considered a quote unquote good decision. And this might be, you know, hey, should I take that job offer? Should I do this, new endeavor? Is this the way to approach this with my kids? Is this relationship right for me? I mean, this is across the board in our lives. And it's interesting because so much of that focuses on the cognitive side, the rational, the logical side of making decisions. Now, I'm not negating the importance of all of that, but it's incomplete. It's an incomplete way of thinking about what might be right for you. I worked with a coach over the course of the last maybe year or so as I was making a really big career decision, and she had me do this really interesting embodiment practice that completely changed the way I think about making the biggest decisions in my life. And that's one of the things that sparked this week's episode. Specifically, she said, you need to get better at paying attention to the signals your body is sending you when you're trying to make a decision. So specifically, she said, let's take something that was a yes. It wasn't just a yes. It was like an H yes, like, oh my God, yes. Something that was so right for you, that was so exciting, that was an absolute guaranteed yes that you wanted to do, something that happened in the past. And then she said, take something that's the opposite. It's a heck no, like, ugh, like, no, I don't want to do this. Absolutely not something you were dreading. And she said, I want you to take those two things, those big dichotomies, and I want you to practice just getting quiet in meditation and calling each of those to mind. And when you do that, pay attention to how your body feels. What do you notice? What do you notice about your face, about your musculature, about your muscles? Maybe it's your posture. Maybe it's your hands sweating, and how do they feel? Maybe, I mean, it could be anything, right? Heart rate, the way you breathe, the way you feel, the emotion you get. What do you get from your body? Ignore everything your mind is telling you. And you know what I noticed? When I thought about the things that were a heck yes, oh my gosh, yes, like absolute yes, I noticed these little subtle muscles in my jaw start to clench. They're the same muscles that clench when you start to smile. They're the ones that tell you, I'm having a good time, I'm enjoying myself. That was one of the first things I noticed about the intelligence that our body and the insight our body can send us in order to help us make decisions. And so I started practicing doing that practice. That practice, PS, was from Shannon Schottler. She's a phenomenal coach. Her website is shannonschottler.com. Check her out. She's awesome. I got that practice from her. And then, coincidentally enough, I met this week's guest, Dr. Amanda Blake, while I was recording for the Wisdom for Life Heart-Mind Institute Self-Care Summit recently. Some of you might have joined us for that. She was one of the guests, and I knew I had to get her on this podcast because of how transformational these embodiment practices were for me and how much I wanted to share them with all of you. But I wanted an expert to actually do it, not just me talking about my own experience. So, quick background before we dive into this interview. Dr. Amanda Blake is the author of the award-winning book, Your Body is Your Brain, and she's the creator of the Body Equals Brain course on the neurobiology of experiential leadership learning. In addition to teaching about the art and science of embodiment, she works with progressive leaders worldwide to help them become their best self, enjoy life more, and make a bigger contribution. Once an internationally competitive athlete, Mandy is skilled at cultivating high performance in herself and others. She's a master somatic leadership coach, holds a degree in human biology from Stanford University, and is both a Fetzer Scholar and a research fellow at the Fowler Center for Business as an agent of world benefit. She's also a longtime yoga enthusiast, mountaineer, musician, and celebrator of life. Woo! I'm so excited for you guys to hear this one. This practice is, or the set of embodiment practices can be absolutely transformational in helping you make some of the biggest decisions of your life. And I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome Dr. Amanda Blake to the show. Let's roll that interview. Mandy, I'm so excited that you're here for this episode. I had such a good time talking to you during the self-care summit, and I just knew I needed to get you on the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. It's really, I'm excited that we get to talk again and go a little deeper on some of the things that we've talked about already. So
yay. Let's roll. Yay. Good. Let's start with the basics, because this, the area that you are an expert in, this idea of embodiment practices, somatic intelligence, this was very new to me. I would say a year to 18 months ago, it blew my mind. And I want to make sure as we dive in, because this topic is so valuable and transformative, that we give people a good overview of what it is in the first place, so we're all jumping off with some sure footing. So can you give us an overview of what embodiment practices are, what somatic intelligence is, and the importance that it can play in our lives?
Yeah, totally. So I want to say, well, aside from mind-blowing and life-transforming, here's what that means.
Right, right. We could just stop there, but we won't. We'll go deeper.
No, I mean, well, the thing is, April, I agree with you, because the same thing is true for me, and it's how and why I wound up devoting my life to deepening my skill in this area and my own embodied self-awareness. So to come back and answer the question, what we're really talking about is your body has an intelligence that, you know, imagine if you were walking around in the world, and I'm going to say you, most of us probably are walking around in the world using a tiny sliver of our intelligence. Mm-hmm. When we learn to tap the information that is just inherently inside of our sensations, our gestures, our posture, the way we move, the way we're breathing in our everyday lives. So this is a little bit different from like going to a yoga or a Tai Chi class, all of which is great, like totally do that. But this is about, you know, you and I are having a conversation and I'm aware of my feet on the floor right now. And how might that serve and support me in having a better, clearer, more exciting, enthusiastic, alive conversation with you? So there is an intelligence in our sensations and our movements that we've, by and large, never been taught to see or understand or make sense of or use. And my job is to help people do that.
That's so good. It's interesting because I'm glad you said that most people aren't taught this, because it was mind-blowing to me when I encountered it. And, you know, it took me until I was over the age of 40 before I ran into it and had any experience. So I'm glad I'm not the only one. Something that I think is really interesting, an interesting connection to make, is that when we encounter some of these concepts, like, you know, embodiment practices, somatic intelligence, I think it's a natural inclination to feel skeptical. And what I would encourage people to think about is the interconnection between our mind and our body, and the way that your body responds when you're in different mindsets. Like, imagine the way your body would respond if you were grieving, or the way your body would respond if you were on a roller coaster, or the way that your body would respond if you were really tired, or any of the other things. Like, we have this connection in the way that our full body, including our mind, is the way that it operates. And is it accurate to say that you're asking us to pay attention to that bodily response, because it in and of itself gives us information about how we might feel about or are processing a situation? Is that accurate, or is there more to it?
Well, it's accurate and there's more to it. So I often say our body is our social and emotional sense organ in the same way that our eyes are our visual sense organ. So we learn things and know things, I would say, about our relationships with other people, about our own response to the world emotionally, about what's drawing us forward or maybe makes us want to hold back. All of that we know largely through our physical sensations. And for a number of neurobiological reasons, that tends to stay outside of our conscious awareness unless and until we're taught how to pay attention and to pay attention to it. Mm. And, you know, I want to say I share your, you sort of pointed to it's this can just sound weird and woo-woo and wacky. And that was true for me. Like I started down this path and started learning some of the things that I now share and teach with people. And I was, you know, we've sort of already made these hyperbolic claims about this being life-changing and mind-blowing, right? But my mind was blown and I was like, hang on, I don't get it, right? Like, what's going, why when I stand differently, am I able to have this really intense, difficult conversation that I never could have had before standing up to a bully at work? Mm-hmm. You know, he had many times torn me down and there was a big age difference and there was a gender difference. And somehow by learning to stand differently and kind of organize myself differently around a felt sense of what was most important to me and what I cared about, all of a sudden I was able to call him out on his behavior and he was totally cowed. And he was like, God, you know, I said, look, I can't speak to you if you're going to treat me this way. We can't work together well. Mm. And he was like, wow, you're right. I really need to do things differently. I mean, it was, you know, you talk about like mind blowing, life transforming. It really, really was. Anyway, I was disturbed by the fact that by standing differently, I could have such a different kind of conversation that had never been accessible or available to me before. And I wanted to try and understand why. And that's how I sort of took my science background and looked at the neurobiology of all of this. And it wound up doing my own research, first secondary research and then direct research on like, what is going on under the hood when we change in these ways? So that's, yeah, enough said about that. But it's weird and woo-woo, and it's also like really grounded, actually, and makes so much sense when you understand it.
That's amazing. Okay, so we've got a group here that does appreciate research and appreciates the fact that the things that we talk about here are very evidence-based. Can you talk a little bit about some of that research, what you've found in terms of, you know, people who might do these embodiment practices might tap into that somatic insight and how that can impact our behavior, impact maybe how we feel in a situation or the outcome of a situation, our capacity for growth. I mean, all of that. Can you talk a little bit about the underlying mechanisms? Like why it's to answer the question you had, why does this work? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, it's a long answer. So that's why I wrote a whole book about it, but I'll give you the short answer. And one of the things that I was really fascinated to find is that when you look into each of the different major systems of the body, so you can look into the digestive system or the circulatory system or the neuromuscular system, you know, you look into kind of heart, gut and lungs and the organs in your torso, there's so much convergent evidence strictly from the field of biology about how our body communicates upward to our brain information about the surrounding world. And it's a sense that we cannot turn off. So like we can close our eyes, we can cover our ears. There's no 24/7, there's actually no way to turn off our body's responsiveness to that roller coaster, whether you're on an actual roller coaster or an emotional roller coaster, right? So it was very interesting to me to find out how much support there was both from neuroscience and just from general biology about the role of the body in our relational life and in our emotional lives. I went on from that, writing that book, Your Body is Your Brain, I went on to do research to go, okay, well, I've collected all this convergent evidence, but that doesn't really tell me what people are really experiencing. And so I went out and interviewed several dozen people and then ultimately wound up serving hundreds of people. I think over 500 people, and did a really close analysis, a statistical analysis of what are the outcomes when someone develops their embodied self-awareness and how does someone develop their embodied self-awareness. And the very short version there is that when we develop embodied self-awareness or this capacity to tap this innate body-oriented intelligence, we develop more flourishing, which is a measure of resilience and well-being. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, a measure of life satisfaction and well-being. We also develop resilience as one of the big things. Another thing that tends to come out of it is greater connectedness and a greater capacity for conflict management. And all of the evidence points to, you'll know this, April, that in psychology, humans are complex and we see small effect sizes. Usually in research, what we're seeing is like, yeah, this nudges it just by a little bit or a little bit more. But what you see is that when you develop embodied self-awareness, like the correlations are off the charts, really high, way above average in terms of effect on resilience, in particular, flourishing and conflict management. So I think what that kind of shows is like, we inherently have this innate biologically based intelligence that we, again, like just no one told us how to hone that skill. We go to school, we learn how to do math, right? And we get better and better and better at it as we go through the years. And then some of us go on and become, like math experts, and some of us drop math. But we go to school and we don't learn, hey, what is that sensation in your body really telling you? Right. And so we don't develop that skill, not even on a like really basic 2+2 level.
And so, I would argue too, just to push into that point a little bit, not only do we not, are we not taught it, we're, it feels like to me, actively discouraged from tapping into it as though it's irrational, illogical. It's not cognitive or deliberative or the correct quote unquote way to make a decision. So not only are we not told, but we're very actively discouraged in some cases.
I think that's really fair to say. And that is a distinction of Western culture in particular.
Yes.
And so not all cultures approach the body in the same way. And in Western culture, the way we have conventionally approached the body and emotions is to deem them primitive, unsophisticated, untrustworthy. And in fact, nothing can be further from the truth. It's very interesting that the newer research about the brain shows that the most salient, clearest, most consistent functional division in the brain is between what's called the empathic network and the analytic network. So people used to think, oh, the biggest division in the brain is right and left. Well, not really. I mean, there are some interesting differences there. And people looked at all these kind of anatomical ways to divide up the brain and go, well, it's this piece versus this piece or that versus that. No, the latest research really shows that these two networks, the analytical and the empathic, are radically different, and they're both reasoning networks, but the empathic network completely relies on all of that information from the body. And it's what allows us to not only empathize with other people, but to, for example, it allows for moral reasoning. Sometimes we have like an ethical decision to make, right? And there are a number of different values that may be in conflict with one another, and we have to think that through. That's not the same as doing math. That's not the same as architecture. It's not the same kind of thinking as we need to manipulate the physical world around us. So most of our education has been about that manipulation, technology, science, and the analytical mode. And we actually, like, the things that affect our lives the most are, you know, dependent on our capacity for moral judgment, our capacity for accurately empathizing with others, our capacity for intimacy and connection. And all of that is really tied into the same neural networks that help our body help the rest of our body talk to the brain in our head.
So good. You know, we talked a little bit before we hopped on to record that, you know, obviously the title of the podcast is Building Psychological Strength. And the term psychological strength, we coined that term very intentionally to point in the direction that a lot of the things we talk about, this one included, involve a practice. They involve something that you can't really check a box and say, you know, you wouldn't go to a gym and pick up a dumbbell and do one bicep curl and woo, check the box. I am jacked now. I am ripped. I don't have to lift weights anymore. It's a progressive thing that takes time. It takes intention in us consistently working on, and it's something we can continuously improve over time. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the practice element of it and give us some practical just examples of practices people can do and ways in which they, even if it's over time, might impact their experience in so many of these domains that we've talked about already.
Yeah, so absolutely. And I want to underscore, like, it does happen over time. You can't get good at any physical skill, whether it's basketball or playing the piano or, you can't get good at swimming by reading a book about swimming. You have to actually get in the water, get wet, and try it. And this is so much that way. It's not an idea that lives in your head. So just wherever you are right now, April, if you, and I would invite listeners to do this too, just allow your spine to be its natural length so that you're neither collapsed, but nor are you like stretching or reaching up. You're just be your natural height and sense, not think about, but see if you can find in sensation your connection to the ground. So if you're sitting down, maybe you're in a chair and you can feel your seat against the chair or your back against the chair or both. If you're standing, maybe you feel the weight of your body resting on your feet, right? Gravity is pulling us into the earth right in this moment. Can you feel that without letting it kind of pull you or weigh you down, but also without struggling up out of it? Just letting your spine be its natural height. And then wherever you're looking, like let your eyes be not neither downcast nor looking up, but just sort of looking out at the horizon, or you could imagine looking out towards your own future, right? So where you're weighted and anchored in your own body, you're standing upright in your own sense of dignity and worth, and you're looking ahead, perhaps towards what it is you're anticipating with pleasure or what it is you wish to create in the world. Or maybe looking ahead to your, you know, your afternoon coffee, if that's your special treat or whatever it may be, right? It doesn't have to be a big deal. And it also, you may notice from what we're doing right here, like, this is a very kind of meeting friendly, I like to call it a meeting friendly practice. You can do this any time of day. You can do this while you're sitting in the car. You should probably do this while you're sitting in traffic. It'll make a difference for how you feel on the inside. And just that simple thing, like let your spine straighten in a comfortable way and let you feel yourself heavy on the earth. That alone can be powerful. And then there are other ways that we can modify, expand, and extend that if you want to talk about that. But I just want to underscore, like, you don't have to go to a special hour-long class once a week to get this. You can do this you know, while you're in that difficult conversation with that bully at work, and it might change the conversation for you.
So let's say people practice this. Like, I mean, because I think it's interesting because any of the mindfulness practices, and I hope it's fair to lump this a little bit underneath that umbrella, a lot of the mindfulness practices that I've done over the years, the initial go at it feels like, oh, okay, cool. I did it. Yeah. Okay, great. But the more you do it, the more you realize initially what I thought I was doing, there's so much more depth to it. Like, you know, tracking your breath, there's so much more that you can notice than what you do the first time. And there's so much more impact that it can have than it does that first time. So can you tell people a little bit about what they might notice experientially if they kind of commit to doing these practices more on the long term?
Yeah. Well, let me go back to this bully situation, which I actually haven't thought about in a long time, but since it came to mind while we're talking, I think it's actually a really good illustration. So I had been doing this practice that I just shared with you, incredibly simple, right? This and many other things for probably 6 months on a daily basis throughout my day, before I was, you know, ultimately able to have this, what was a very intense and difficult conversation. So I often say, you know, you don't, like an Olympic athlete doesn't just wake up one morning and go to the Olympics. There's like years of training that go into that. So you don't want to expect that, like you said, you know, I've been to the gym, now I have the strength I need. If you're going to be building psychological strength, it happens in little bits and little bits over time. And I wouldn't expect it to immediately change your hardest, most difficult conversation. But what can happen over time as your body develops the muscle memory of not just straightening your spine, not just feeling yourself present on the earth right in this moment, but also feeling, let's say, a felt sense connection to something that you deeply care about. So you can do that now, like just, you know, inhale, straighten your spine, exhale, feel the weight of yourself here present on the earth, and just call to mind and to heart someone or something that makes you smile. And see if you can get a real feeling of that smile, not just on your face, but like the suffusion of warmth through your whole body. And then you could even imagine that glow growing, expanding, extending, maybe even out beyond the edges of your skin, right? So you do that again and again and again, 10 times a day, 10 times a day, 10 times a day. And then, you know, your toddler throws a tantrum and you're like, oh, right. Your body remembers, oh, right. Oh, I remember what it feels like to straighten my spine, to feel myself here, to smile. Like, I love this child right now. I want to pull my hair out, but I love this child. And this time I actually have access to a little more patience. Right. And so in many ways, that's what happened for me with this bully, is that my body developed this muscle memory. I remember the scene so clearly. I was on, standing on my deck, and there was this ray of sunshine. Like, it was the one sunny spot in my deck, and he was cursing at me. And I actually took the phone away from my ear, and I did exactly what we're talking about now. I straightened my spine. I got heavy on my feet, and I reminded myself of what I care about. Like, hey, wait a minute. I'm worthy of respect. And I, you know, tuned back into whatever he was saying, and I interrupted him and I said, look, the way you're treating me right now doesn't make me want to partner with you. And if we're going to succeed at this project, we need to be able to work together. So I need to insist that you treat me with more respect.
Wow. Like,
I had never said anything like to me, my heart was make no mistake. Like, it wasn't comfortable for me to do this. My heart's beating in my chest. I'm sweating. I'm like, I can't believe I'm saying this. But it was, you know, like I said, it was incredibly powerful. And I sort of called him on the carpet and he acquiesced and he said, yeah, you know what? I was out of line. I'm sorry. And I can't say that he was suddenly an angel thenceforth, but what it did is it shifted the relationship so that I could, you know, then in moments where he was starting to get heated again, I would say, remember that conversation we had? Mm-hmm. Like, if you need to cool down before we continue this conversation, I'm happy to give you the time to do that.
That's so good.
Yeah. So that's what can happen if you practice over time a lot. I think it's like you said, and I agreed, can be absolutely life-changing.
Yeah. You know, we talk a lot on here about Viktor Frankl has this quote about between a stimulus, so anything that's coming into us from our environment, internal, external, between that stimulus and how our ultimate response, our behavior, what we do, there's a gap. And inside that gap is an opportunity for us to cultivate our response, be more intentional and thoughtful about how we might respond. And we talk a lot about how what puts you in the gap is being mindful and the practices that you develop when you are doing mindfulness practices. If you're repeatedly teaching yourself to be in your body, to be grounded, to remind yourself what's important, that gap is where your mind develops its habits and its ways of operating as a default in the world. And if we don't do any of these things, it tends to move in a direction that isn't that helpful for us. It tends to get very reactive. It tends to get very anxious. It tends to get very external. But if we can put these practices in place that sort of, we're never going to get rid of our mind's natural tendency, right? You still got anxious in that situation. But to insert something else into that gap alongside anxiety, a reminder of, yes, I'm anxious about this, but there's a deeper importance here. My dignity is also important here. Yes, I'm anxious, but also it dilutes out the impact of the anxiety and we're able to act. And so what you're saying is not, there's some, you know, this goes back to your point of it sounds very woo, but it's not like poof, there's some magic, you know, glitter that shoots out of the air when you do this and something magical happens. You're literally training your mind and training your whole self to show up in situations like that differently and giving yourself a set of tools to rely on in addition to the anxiety and all the other things that your mind might throw you. It's a huge asset in any situation that might be difficult or ambiguous or murky or, you know, hard to see the path forward. What a set of tools to cultivate for yourself to make some better decisions.
You know, absolutely. And I have like 100 things that I want to say in response to that.
That's always the scary part of these podcasts. They can go so off the rails. It's so easy.
Oh man. So one of the things that I am interested to respond to is, you know, your idea of psychological strength and building psychological strength, like you're building a muscle over time is very, I talk about that, with respect to resilience, right? And, my way of thinking about that is when we can increase both the speed of our recovery, we can't not get thrown off. As you pointed out, like we're going to get thrown off, but if we can increase the speed of our recovery, we can come back faster to a place where we're, at more of our best, right? If not our actual best, and increase the frequency of our recovery. So we come back more often. When we come back more often and faster to a, I'm going to call it a centered place. I don't always like that term, but what I mean by that is a place of what the scientists will call psychophysiological coherence. In other words, a place where all of our systems all of our biological system, rhythmic systems are aligned. So our breath rate, our blink rate, and this is what we feel like when we're calm. These systems are all aligned. When we're frazzled, you can look on a graph and see, wow, everything's beating at a different rate, right? No wonder you feel weird inside. And a lot of the times when we get reactive, or we have some behavior that we later regret, we take some action that we're like, man, that's the thing that I always do. Or, geez, I wish I really hadn't said that thing, right? I shouldn't have flown off the handle, or I wish I had stepped up, or whatever it is. A lot of times what's happening is we are reacting to the discomfort in our body and we're trying to make it go away by often either hiding out and avoiding the situation or going to battle and fighting in the situation, right? And we'll do either of those things. And sometimes there are other responses too, but those are the two most common where we'll get stuck. And we're stuck because we're uncomfortable. That's what we'll say, right? Like, oh, I was so uncomfortable in that situation. Well, it's often a physical discomfort. And we're trying to resolve that discomfort with our actions, with our behavior. When we can actually resolve that discomfort internally first by shifting how we're standing, how we're breathing, how we're holding tension in our eyes or our jaw, how we're feeling our feet on the floor, all of these really fairly simple things that we can do. When we shift that deliberately, it opens up. People say this all the time. Oh my gosh, I didn't even know those words were available there. That was true for me with that bully, right? Like the words that we need just show up for ourselves. And that's what's true when we're calm and on our best. We're not trying to think of the right thing to say. We just say what's going on, right? Like when we're really at our best, we're able to think clearly and communicate clearly. And when we're thrown off physically and physiologically, a lot of what happens is the blood flow that normally is going to the more logical thinking centers of our brain kind of shunts back. And, you know, as we know, under stress, we send blood to other parts of our body in order to respond to the stress, right? So what I often say is we know that stress is physiological, right? And since we know that stress is physiological, it makes sense that resilience has to be physiological. We have to build that in our
body. That's good.
Right? Because we can't just show up to stress with like the good idea that we read in the book. Because that part of our brain is offline when we're stressed. It's not helping us.
Oh, that's so good. No one has ever put it that way before. That if stress is physiological, then resilience has to be. That's so good.
Yeah.
And you pointed out that the long-term outcome of this is that we are more capable in our relationships professionally. Just, I can imagine even personally, the way that we are in relationship with ourselves, like it is just this powerhouse of a set of tools that's worth cultivating because of the outcome it can have on our life experience. And I feel like that's what we're all after by studying this work and putting these practices into our lives and actually doing them.
Yeah. You know, I almost subtitled my book, How to Get Smarter at What Matters Most.
Ooh, that's good.
And I think that's really what this work can do. It's certainly what it's done for me. And in the other conversations that we've had, April, it sounds like it's had that kind of an impact on your life too. Like the things that matter most to us suddenly become way more accessible, whether it's, you know, we've talked a lot in this conversation about having challenging conversations, but it's also challenging to go after our dreams,
yes.
Right? It's scary. It involves risk and it involves courage and vulnerability and, you know, stepping out in ways that we maybe haven't done before or challenging ourselves in ways that we maybe haven't done before. And all of that can also, you know, initiate the kind of reactivity that might keep us closed or safe or away from what we most deeply long for in life. And so I really do feel like this is a path of getting literally smarter about what matters most to us.
That is awesome. I mean, I'm just going to pretend that that's the subtitle of the book because I think it's so great. I mean, it points to the alternative, right? What happens if we don't do this? And it can be so easy. In my case, when I discovered this set of practices, I found myself so off course and wondering how in the heck I got myself to that place. How did I not see that the set of decisions that I made that got me there were just not, I mean, compounding the situation, not the right set of decisions for me. And it's because I was muscling through on brain alone, logic alone, thinking through the costs and benefits of a situation and not paying attention one iota to whether, you know, one of those routes was the true right one for me, whether it aligned to what my values and my end goals and desires were. And when you compound a set of decisions like that over and over, 3-4 decisions in, you find yourself in a place that is very far from where you actually want to be. And that's when I say this is life changing. It was, because once I realized I was there, it was this set of practices that allowed me to have brutally hard conversations to steer the ship back. So it's both proactive and reactive. If you find yourself in a situation that isn't the right one for you, this stuff is life changing. That's why I knew I had to have you on.
Yeah. Well, and you heard me giggling too, because you were talking about like muscling through with kind of your thinking self alone. There's an iconic moment in my life that I go back to again and again, I wrote about this a bit in the book where I was in college. I was trying to decide like, what am I going to do next? And I was very blessed to have options and to graduate college at a time when there were options, right? And I was trying to decide between a variety of things, and it was all like on a spreadsheet and all pros and cons, right? And it, you know, fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I still write lists of pros and cons, but what I do now is I gather all the information and then I step away from it. And I look at how the totality of all that information feels from the inside. Mm. And there's, you know, in the same way that you can get really good at math or computer science or English literature or, you know, fill in the blank teaching, right? Whatever it is, like you study a field, you get really good at it. It's also just important to realize, like, I think there's a little bit of a mistaken assumption out there that all you need to do is check in with your gut and you'll always get the right answer. Mm. And that's not actually true. And I don't want to open a whole can of worms towards the end of our conversation here, but I just maybe want to issue put a little warning label on that says like, you can get right and wrong answers in math. And I don't really want to say you can get right and wrong answers from your body, but you can get helpful and misleading answers from your body. And it takes time, you know, you underlined this is a practice. It takes time to learn to distinguish your own signals from the inside. Is this one that I can and want to trust and follow? Or is this one that actually is coming from some old history, some old assumptions that are no longer valid?
Yeah.
And so I just want to mention that because I think it's easy to misunderstand this as again, like sort of we said at the beginning, like we dismiss it as unsophisticated. It's actually incredibly sophisticated. And to make good use of it, we can do just a little bit, but the more we do, the more sophisticated we get.
That's so good. I feel like everybody needs to read your book because it's just, it just goes so much deeper into everything that we've talked about. So the book is Your Body is Your Brain. Can you talk about where people can find the book, where they can connect with you, learn more about your work, and just deepen the practice that we've just scratched the surface of today?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is available at any bookseller. So you can certainly find it on Amazon if you go that route, but independent booksellers all have the book too. So please support your local independent bookseller if you can. Where else to find me? So the website where you can learn more about this and listen more to other podcasts and get a bunch of free resources is called Embright, Embright.org. Embright.org. And there's, I think you may have this link, April, to a centering challenge that, and it's right there on the front page of the website. It's called Stress to Serenity. And it takes the little tiny piece that we did in just in this conversation and breaks it down and expands it much, much further. So that's available for free on the website. People can take advantage of that if they're so inclined. And lots of other good free resources there as well.
Perfect. Amazing. I'll make sure I link that up in the description of this episode. So if you're on your device, you can just swipe up and you can click right in to get all of those resources. Mandy, this was so great. It was so nice to chat with you again after self-care. And also, I just am such a proponent of these practices, and it was great to bring them to this audience and make sure that we are giving the value of this set of practices to this audience, because I know it can just be transformational. So thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, April, for having me. It's once again been an absolute blast of a conversation. So thank you.
Incredible. All right, friends, stick around. I have a few more things that I want to make sure that I let you know about, a few resources that will just help deepen and expand the conversation that we had today, things that I just couldn't get into because we have a limited amount of time. So stick around for just a minute. I'll be right back with those resources. All right. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Dr. Amanda Blake. We've mentioned it over and over, but these practices are ones that can be truly life-changing. If you continuously work on them over the long run, you will notice things shifting. Three things that I want to point out before we close this episode out. Number one, the first resource I have for you is one from Dr. Blake. I've linked the link to her centering challenge. It's called Stress to Serenity. You can just scroll down and get directly to that challenge so you can start to kick things off in your own life. The other two episodes that I wanted to make sure that I called out, one is with my personal coach, Shannon Schottler. I mentioned her in the introduction. She is the first person who introduced me to this embodiment sort of physical insight work, and it was amazing, completely outstanding. So I would love for you to get to know her a little bit more and see what she has to say. So her episode is linked below. She's my personal coach. She is absolutely phenomenal. I want you to definitely check her out. And the last one that I wanted to talk about is this episode. It's episode 341. It's called Using Microbehaviors to Combat Anxiety. So much of what we're talking about on today's episode with Dr. Blake is really this connection between our mind and our body and our emotions and our life experience. This episode, this microbehavior episode, is one that leans on cognitive behavioral theory. And really that just points to everything I just mentioned, the connection between our mind and our body, and specifically the impact that our behavior has on how our mind responds. Our behavior and our body sends a powerful message to our mind to tell it whether we're okay or not. So when our mind encounters a situation it doesn't understand, or one that feels ambiguous, or one that feels even slightly threatening, it immediately gets anxious. That's its job. But we can use our behaviors, we can use our body to send a signal back to our mind to say, you know what? Thanks for worrying about me. We're actually okay out here. Everything is okay. And so that episode, 341, Using Microbehaviors to Combat Anxiety, is one where we dissect the interconnection between our mind, our body, our emotions, our life experience. And I offer some practical tips about how you can start to use your own behavior to calm your mind down and calm your anxiety. So I hope those three resources help. And I really hope you enjoyed this episode with Dr. Amanda Blake. I loved speaking with her on the Self-Care Summit. If you joined us from the Self-Care Summit and that's why you're here, hi, thank you. I love that you're here. And please stick around because we talk to experts like this all the time. Such valuable content. And I challenge every single expert that's on this podcast to make their content actionable. Tell us how we can actually put it into practice and use it in our lives. And this is one that is just directly applicable to our day-to-day lives. And finally, let's remember that time is the most non-renewable resource on the planet. And I'm grateful to each and every one of you who chose to spend some of your precious time with me today. I'm Dr. April Seifert, and I will see you next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.